Hej kära vänner och varmt välkomna till ett nytt avsnitt av Långköraren Sinnessjukt. En podd av och med mig, den okarismatiske Christian Dahlström. Jag hoppas att ni mår bra där ute i det kompakta vintermörker som råder nu när jag spelar in det här. Själv mår jag inte toppen, det måste jag ärligt säga, men så är det ju för mig så här års, så det hade ni kanske räknat ut redan. Jag kan tänka mig att en del av er känner likadant. Det här är ju det sista gratisavsnittet för året, så innan jag presenterar det vill jag passa på att tacka alla er som har lyssnat i år. Det har varit ett otroligt år tycker jag, med allt från Freud-dokumentären till Elias Eriksson, Dan Katz, Cynthia Bjulik, Amir Sarjaslan och nu den här väldigt intressanta intervjun med Craig Bryan. Och om ni inte är patroner än så kan man ju bli det under bara jullovet om man vill och lyssna i kapp på de avsnitt man missat under året. Sen kan man återgå till att bli gratislyssnare med ett klick. Det är verkligen så enkelt, så jag rekommenderar er att bli det. Jag föreställer mig hur ni liksom smyger undan familjen under julledigheten och slår igång Freud-dokumentären och låter er förföras av det som jag nog tycker är den mest intressanta historiska personen av alla, charlatanernas charlatan. En historia i fyra delar berättad av tre av världens främsta experter. Ett otroligt mys måste jag säga. Men idag ska ni få den andra delen av min intervju med Craig Bryan, den amerikanska suicidforskaren och professorn på Ohio State University som har skrivit den intressanta boken Rethinking Suicide. I det här avsnittet pratar vi om bedömning av självmordsrisk och varför det är så svårt med dagens verktyg. Craig får berätta hur han tror att man kan förbättra de verktygen i framtiden. Kan exempelvis maskininlärning, som hittills har varit en besvikelse i det här fältet, kan det vara en del av lösningen framöver? Det var väldigt intressant att höra honom resonera om det. I slutet av dagens avsnitt kommer vi dessutom in på de psykoterapier som kan minska patienters självmordstankar och självmordsförsök, vilket förstås också är superintressant att höra mer om. Innan jag drar igång vill jag också rikta mig till dig som har självmordstankar just nu. Det finns hjälp att få, även om läget känns nattsvart just nu och det inte alltid är lätt att få hjälp så finns det alltid hopp. Glöm inte det. Jag lägger in en kort länk i avsnittsbeskrivningen till 1177s sida med mer information om var man kan söka hjälp. Du kan naturligtvis också googla 1177 och självmord så hittar du rätt direkt. Men med det sagt så får ni spetsa öronen när vi återigen ska få prata med professor Craig Bryan på en Zoom-lina från Columbus, Ohio från den 7 november i år. Varsågoda! Talking about the difficulty in predicting suicide, you describe in great detail in your book why today's suicide screening methods unfortunately have major flaws. Can you tell us a little about these flaws?
Yeah, so the sort of prevailing approach to suicide prevention screening right now is to ask people about suicidal ideation or suicidal thoughts. And the assumption underlying this, the reason why we do it is that we assume, right, you have to think about suicide before you try to kill yourself. And so I think relatedly, there is this classic assumption of people like think about suicide, they contemplate it, they make these plans, and they kind of ruminate about it for days or weeks, sometimes longer, and then they eventually attempt suicide. So if we can figure out who is thinking about suicide, that's an early indicator of the pathway. It's a gateway to suicide, and we can intervene. You know, the challenge with that approach is that we've known for at least 50 years that half of people who die by suicide don't experience suicidal ideation, or they are unwilling to disclose that they're having suicidal thoughts. And so I think this is most relevant for these rapid intensification cases where people become suicidal incredibly fast. And we're seeing in some of our newer research, which I think helps to build on decades of research, a significant percentage of people are saying, I first experienced suicidal thoughts as I was attempting suicide. So it wasn't that I thought about it and then I attempted. It was like things just happened.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
And I can't really say that I thought about it in advance. And so all of this is to say is that we keep expanding and keep sort of emphasizing asking about thoughts of suicide. And I think it can be helpful for some people to identify some people at risk, but we're consistently missing the majority of people. And instead of focusing on developing better ways to identify people at risk, we just kind of keep doing the same thing over and over again, and we're not actually innovating, we're not actually making anything better. And I think what we're starting to realize within the past year or so of research is that there are perhaps certain circumstances where this screening approach can actually be harmful, where it can perhaps be stigmatizing to people, where maybe we overreact to their suicidal ideation, and perhaps, or it kind of redirects us away from the highest risk people. And so there are these consequences, unintended consequences of expanding suicidal ideation screening, where in essence, if you use an unreliable, not particularly accurate method, and you just keep doing it more and more and more, the likelihood of people benefiting actually drops. The likelihood of people experiencing negative outcomes and consequences actually increases. And so it might be this inadvertent sort of feedback loop where our attempts to prevent suicide may actually be unintentionally making things worse.
Yeah, and what was also striking when you described this is that even for people who do have almost daily suicidal ideations, these emotions vary greatly during the day. So depending on when during the day you ask them, their emotional state can be very different. And it also depends a lot on how you ask them. So if you... I think you give one example where if the question states that if you have suicidal ideations, we will have to contact your employer or something along those lines, then people are a lot less willing to disclose that they have these suicidal ideations.
Yeah, it's, it's what you're speaking to there is that there are consequences to the actions that we take, and there might be certain circumstances or situations where the consequences of screening, of the negative consequences of screening, outweigh the positive benefits or the positive consequences. And so, all this is to say is that this, I don't think we should be simplifying the issue to is screening good or bad, but rather we should be thinking about when is screening helpful, for whom, under what circumstances, and then what are the what are the places, the times, and the populations where screening maybe is not going to be as helpful, or maybe a different strategy would be better than asking about suicidal ideation. And so it's a more nuanced, it's a more complicated question. This gets to, it kind of speaks to the issue of, in the book, I also characterize suicide as a wicked problem. And that this is like the heart and soul of the wicked problem, is that there is no solution. And that something that works one time will not work another time. And so you have to think in this more complicated way about the issue. And that's certainly true with screening. There's definitely a time and a place that for screening, it can be very, very helpful, very useful. I just worry that we assume it's always beneficial, always helpful, and always useful. And that just certainly doesn't seem to be borne out by the data.
Yeah, let me just ask you about that, because I was wondering, because you write that even if suicide screening is very difficult with today's methods, you still think it's important to do it. Why is it still important, or on what occasions?
Yeah, because there is a subgroup of people who think about suicide, they ruminate on it, and then they attempt. And so suicidal ideation for some people can be a marker of elevated risk. And so that assumption we've had all along is true some of the time. And so there is value in asking the question. What I worry about, and really what I'm speaking against in the book, is that I think it's inappropriate to extrapolate from those sort of subset of instances where something is valuable and saying, therefore, it's valuable all the time, everywhere, for everybody. And that's not the case. And I think us adopting that oversimplified perspective, again, not only are there potential consequences associated that might actually work against our goal to prevent suicide, but I also think it represents an opportunity lost, where it will sometimes serve as a barrier for us to identify and develop better strategies in those other circumstances, because it's sort of like, no, we can't do anything else other than screen for suicidal ideation. That's the only way to approach it. Again, from the view of a wicked problem conceptualization, that's a fundamental flaw. There is no single solution. And you can only understand things that work as, you know, strategies are either better or worse. There's no right or wrong, right? And I think we could potentially improve our efforts to prevent suicide if we were to say, yeah, ideation screening works sometimes, and it's really helpful there. And perhaps a different approach is going to be better somewhere else under different circumstances.
In what ways could suicide screening tools be designed to better catch who's at risk and who's not?
Yeah. So, you know, one example, for instance, where a lot of the studies that are often cited as supporting the value of screening, they often come from like very high clinical acuity settings. So mental health clinics, hospitals, emergency departments, where, you know, people who are very suicidal are much more likely to be found, right? And so one of the mathematical kind of truths about screening tools is that when the thing that you're looking for, the condition, when it is very common in a population, the performance of your screening tool gets better because there are more cases, right, to find. But if that condition is rare, and the more rare it becomes, in essence, the math works against you. And your tool, even if it's the exact same tool that's really, really good somewhere else, suddenly becomes unreliable and is error prone. And so that's where it's sort of like recognizing that what we do in a hospital, what we do in a mental health clinic, a therapy office, things that can be very valuable and helpful in those settings will perhaps perform much worse, much differently in a general medical setting, in a community, in a school, things like that. And it's simply a function, to be honest, of the math underlying the whole concept of signal detection. And I think those sort of limits are not fully recognized by the suicide prevention field. It's usually kind of surprising when I talk about this with other suicide prevention advocates, where I'm like, in essence, the math, we cannot overcome it. It's a natural barrier, and there's nothing we will be able to do to get past that, you know, that limit. And I think if we were to just accept that, say it's okay, it's unfortunate, but it's okay, that would, again, I think, liberate us to say, well, then what else could we be doing that might work better under those circumstances?
Yeah, I think you also mentioned machine learning, for instance, and looking at other parameters, mm-hmm. like social media postings that could indicate that someone is feeling worse, or is that something that could be helpful in detecting who's at risk of suicide?
Yeah, so possibly. And I think it depends, though, on how you use those tools. There's growing consensus now that, you know, machine learning, predictive analytic models for screening purposes, they actually aren't any better than old low-tech versions. And so, you know, the way we used to do screening is still common now. You go into a clinic and you get maybe a checklist right on a clipboard, or maybe now it's on a tablet and you get asked a bunch of questions and you say yes or no, or you provide your ratings. That's the historic way of screening for suicide risk. So those low tech, low cost, easily accessible methods are actually about as good as the really expensive, really fancy, really complicated machine learning models. And so a lot of the investment in these really fancy, sophisticated modeling techniques are not actually meaningfully improving this detection of cases. And again, it's because the mathematical limits, you can't violate the laws of the universe. You know, you're going to be boundaried by that. So those are some examples of where I think the application of the tool of machine learning or AI or social media is sort of fundamentally limited. There might be other instances, though, where the tool is incredibly helpful. And there was a paper just published within the past few weeks that, by reaction to it, and a colleague, I was like, this is the first application of machine learning that I think could actually make a difference in suicide prevention. And what was found was that, in essence, they basically profiled patients who presented to hospitals with a suicidal crisis. And they use machine learning to classify those patients into several groups. There's one group for whom hospitalization was beneficial. It was shown to reduce suicide risk post-discharge, although only for a short period of time. There's another group for whom hospitalization increased risk for suicide, so it was worse. And then there was another group for whom hospitalization didn't really seem to have any impact on their risk for suicide. So now this could actually be really, really useful, right? Because if we could use a tool like that when a patient comes into a hospital, where we could perhaps profile them and say, are you, as an individual, are you likely to benefit from a particular treatment? That would help us to provide personalized interventions. It could avoid, you know, misclassifying someone where we think it'll be helpful, but actually it's harmful. And if hospitalization is not going to do anything at all, good or bad, well, then what's the point of doing it, right? And so there's, I think, a perfect example of where machine learning and some of the newer, more sophisticated computational methods could actually lead to really important advances in suicide prevention, because there, you know, that the way that the tool is being used, they're not bounded by some of those mathematical problems. It's like a perfect application of that tool.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
All right, and there are a couple of different evidence-based psychotherapies that reduce suicidal thinking and suicidal behaviors. Can you tell us a little bit about these psychotherapies and what they have in common?
Yeah, so the first thing I think as we talk about this is recognizing that suicidal thoughts and suicidal behaviors are different outcomes. We tend to collapse them together as like suicide risk. But the things that correlate with suicidal thinking are different from the things that correlate with suicidal behaviors. And we see differences in treatment. So for instance, treatments that reduce suicidal behaviors, they in essence get people to stop trying to kill themselves. These are things like brief cognitive behavioral therapy for suicide prevention and dialectical behavior therapy are kind of the two most well-researched. There are a few other treatments that have shown some early promise, but only cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical behavior therapy have been shown in multiple studies to prevent suicide attempts. All right, so those are kind of the core things that work to reduce attempts, and they share, those two treatments share a focus on self-regulation strategies, teaching people how to recognize when you're emotionally overwhelmed and what to do about it, how to calm yourself down, how to distract yourself, sort of like how to control your emotions. Then we have other treatments that seem to reduce suicidal ideation, but not suicidal attempts. And the best example of this, I think, is the Collaborative Assessment and Management of Suicidality, or CAMS, which has been shown in lots and lots of studies to more rapidly reduce suicidal ideation, but it has not been shown to prevent suicide attempts. And so we're getting to a point now, in essence, where we might even be able to start matching different types of therapies to the unique needs of the patients, depending on how they present, what their problems are, and what their goals are.
Yeah, and this might be a stupid question, but they reduce suicidal thinking and behaviors, but do they also reduce the risk of suicide or suicide rates or...
You know, so no study has yet been conducted that shows a therapy or treatment prevents death by suicide. And that's because, you know, suicide death is so rare, so statistically infrequent that you would need enormous studies to do that. And so the studies that have the best evidence and support look at suicide attempts more broadly, whether a person, and that includes people who attempt suicide and die, but more often it's people who attempt suicide and survive afterwards. And the extrapolation then is if a treatment can reduce the likelihood of someone making that suicidal act, then we can eventually lead to reductions in death. And so right now there have been some studies that have kind of done simulations where we aggregate across many, many published studies. And for instance, one machine learning is another great example of good use of machine learning. Took some of those research findings from our studies of brief cognitive behavioral therapy for suicide prevention, BCBT. And they were able to estimate that if we were to use BCBT for all patients everywhere instead of what we're currently doing in mental health treatment, for every 100 patients that receive BCBT instead of existing mental health care, we could prevent 1 to 3 deaths by suicide. That's kind of the furthest we've been able to get right now as it relates to death as an outcome.
Ja visst, där är den andra delen av min intervju med Craig Bryan i mål. Den tredje delen ska jag försöka få ut på julafton, vilket jag ibland försöker att pricka eftersom jag tänker att det kanske kan fylla någons jul ifall man sitter ensam eller så. I den tredje och avslutande delen pratar vi om att psykoterapierna som fungerar används i väldigt liten utsträckning, och ibland när exempelvis DBT används så används urvattnade versioner som inte bara fungerar sämre utan i värsta fall kan orsaka skada. Jag frågar även hur man kan veta vem som ska behandlas med suicidinriktade terapier istället för att bara inom citationstecken behandla deras psykiska sjukdom som vanligt. Sen i slutet av det avsnittet pratar vi om det som jag tycker var mest intressant av allt, means restrictions, och att självmordsprevention historiskt sett har riktat in sig mycket på individen och inte miljön eller samhället. Missa inte det för allt i världen, men även om ni gör det så kommer den här podden tillbaka.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Nästa år såklart. Ta nu hand om varandra där ute så hörs vi snart igen. Puss och kram. Hej då.